Hey, go-getters, let Noom Sport Hydration Tablets power up your fun and keep you ready to move. Simply drop, dissolve, and enjoy crisp and refreshing flavors like strawberry lemonade or lemon lime. With 5 essential electrolytes and crafted with clean, non-GMO, vegan, and gluten-free ingredients, Noom should be your go-to hydration choice. Because when you're hydrated, you can do more, go further, and recover quicker. Shop now on NoomLife.com and get ready for endless fun, because anything can happen after noon.
I think we often miss the connection between farming and our lives, our daily lives. Okay, maybe we're thinking about farmers when we eat, but even then they are sometimes invisible as we try to fit a home-cooked meal into our busy schedules. But what I am talking about here is bigger than that. It could be as big as our planet, that big. But I'm going to make it easier for us all. Let's zoom in closer to our own personal health, and closer still, to our fitness. Today we have the privilege of meeting Rachel Stewart, who left her life in fitness to become a rancher. The two are very connected, and Rachel is not the only farmer I have talked farm with who found farming while seeking the perfect fuel to feed her body. Yes, you will find that list in the show notes. Welcome to Talk Farm to Me, the podcast that brings you closer to the power of your own choices, one farmer at a time. I am your host, Dana DePrima. I am deeply committed to bringing farmers to you so that you can get to know them and what they face to bring you closer to understanding the farmers in your own community. And I know, whether you know them now or not, you want to, because your personal health depends on it and your family's health. And the health of your air and your water and your soil, too. Your community's economic health and even national politics. We want choices as a consumer, and we are dangerously close to losing those choices. If small, local, and regional farming does not have our support, it will disappear. It is disappearing. That's why we're here talking farm, and by talking farm, you will be armed with a deeper understanding of your local landscape and how your actions, daily small actions, like what you eat for breakfast, matter.
You transitioned from a life in fitness. Now you're a farmer, rancher. Tell me what that looked like and how did that happen?
So it was actually the pandemic. Being in fitness, food is the most important thing. But I think people don't understand there's even more than just macros, you know, protein, carbs, or fats. It's more about like whole food. And then how is that whole food produced, like the grass-fed and things like that.
Macros is short for macronutrients, a term used to describe the nutrients your body needs in large amounts, specifically carbohydrates, fat, and protein. Tracking macros is crucial in fitness, as it enables individuals to manage their nutritional intake effectively, ensuring a balanced diet that supports specific fitness goals, whether it be muscle gain, fat loss, or overall performance improvement.
So there's various levels to understanding your food and how it affects the body. But when they started limiting our meat purchases at the store, that's what really shifted my mindset, because I had everything calculated. Like I weighed out all the meals for my family and the purchases. I knew how much my kids were eating every meal. I've homeschooled my 4 children for many years. And so I was like, we need to get into meat production. We need to get into farming. And it kind of just really progressed to where I started looking into the farms, and I'm Filipino and Mexican, and my kids are Filipino, Mexican, and Black. And I was like, there's no Black farms here.
Currently, less than 1% of farms in the United States are Black-owned, according to the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA. This number has dramatically decreased in the last century, where in 1919, 14% of farmland was Black-owned.
What's going on? I couldn't find any to learn from, study from. So during that time, I did study at True Garden, which is in Mesa, Arizona. They are an indoor hydroponic facility. And they, during the pandemic, were shipping their lettuce to Saudi Arabia and all over the world because the food crisis was just crazy at that time. It still is, you know, but it really kind of jump-started everything. So I purchased land by that spring or summerish. It was 10 acres. And we moved into it into the fall and then started buying livestock and farming off-grid. So we didn't have water. We were hauling water and we didn't have funding or anything like that. So we had the GoFundMe and different things that were like really, really supportive. And during that time, we grew a lot. Our herds grew. I've farmed almost every livestock you can think of except horses. So I've had cows, goats, sheep, alpacas, turkeys, chickens, ducks, and I've actually successfully bred everything naturally. But we were off-grid farming for 2 years. And then we were able to go commercial and buy 150 acres of an old commercial farm. And then I was able to buy 40 acres and a meat facility. And during that time, I was selling meat and I had to go all the way to Northern California from Southern Arizona on the border of Mexico to go get my lamb, goat, hog, and everything USDA processed because they didn't have all species facilities here. And I wanted my label on my stuff and they didn't process the way that I wanted.
Many farmers drive multiple hours one way to their nearest inspected processing facility, which raises their cost per pound due to the time and cost of fuel, also causing the animals stress along the way. This is a big issue for smaller farms because the demand for their product varies, so this extra cost doesn't allow them to be as profitable while creating an inhumane environment for the animals that need to be transported for long distances. I'm going to link two episodes in the show notes here. One on the Prime Act, a key piece of legislation currently on the table in Congress, and another one on the struggles with USDA processing availability and scheduling, featuring Carrie Edsall of Black Willow Pond Farm.
During this time, I've studied a lot with the universities, but not just universities. I've learned a lot from my wonderful friends like you and other friends. I love looking at the big commercial operations and how they function, how important, you know, the losses are, like where they learn. And I'm so grateful. I've actually got to go to White Oak Pastures twice. So I've studied at White Oak. I love Will and Jenny Harris, and their meat facility has been a big inspiration for me. So I went there twice last year before I was able to close on my meat facility this year in the spring.
White Oak Pastures in Bluffton, Georgia has gained popularity for its commitment to regenerative agriculture practices, emphasizing grass-fed and pasture-raised livestock. The farm's dedication to environmentally friendly methods, holistic management, and providing local, organic, and transparently sourced products has resonated with consumers. Known for sustainable farming practices and a focus on soil health, White Oak Pastures has become a recognized name in the realm of ethical and high-quality food production. Will Harris has appeared on Talk Farm to Me and also on Farm Talks Q&A on Instagram. I will link both in the show notes.
So I'm hoping that it can be functioning by the beginning of next year. So by the end of this year, it should be custom exempt. And really, it's cool because I was able to get my livestock up to 50 sheep, 50 goats, 50 hogs. And then we had over 50 birds. Unfortunately, I've gone through a divorce last year. And it was really bad. There's a lot of legal stuff, so I'm not going to go into it deeply. And through God, nothing is lost. So I'm rebuilding. I still have my farms and I have a wonderful ranch manager. She's wonderful. So she's on the farm helping me. But it's definitely been like a crazy journey. And I'm just so grateful for the real farmers and the people who've been there. And surprisingly, through this journey, this like up and down, it's been the women. Women have been so supportive. And then there's been one man who was the USDA Minority Committee Leader. Mr. Harvey Reed has been real supportive of me. So it's been real inspirational. And I've learned to find peace and do things that I never thought I could do.
It's so impressive that you have built all of this in such a short time
3 years. It seems short to some people, but it seems long to me. I knew I needed a meat facility in 2020. So I'm like, 2023, I was able to acquire it. My background is fitness, but I actually have a bachelor's in global business and I have an MBA. I'm real business oriented and I'm really happy to be going through these processes that I never thought I could do. It's like, I knew I could be the farmer, but now I have to go through the paperwork.
You have to wear a lot of hats as a farmer, that's for sure. Now, I want to step back for a minute,
yeah.
But tell me about your kids and their role in the farm. You're homeschooling them, and I've seen you guys together on the farm with all of your livestock.
Oh my God. Well, they would take care of all of the livestock. They would graze them. They would feed them. They love the animals. And growing up, I did like a 6 month span of homeschool. And that was the only time I've been familiar with homeschooling. And then I've been really lucky that my youngest was actually never in school. So they've been very important to the operation. They've been the real farmers, really taking care of everything. But right now it's tricky because we're in this custody thing. But I'm hope that they'll be back on the farm soon. That's the goal right now.
So they're not with you on the farm right now?
No. It's crazy because other than that issue, it's like everything else is going really well. And as bad as those issues got, the farmers knew and they've been so supportive. These people just keep stepping up and they know me, you know, and they know that I've been studying the meat, studying the animals, like doing the meetings, building my nonprofit, doing the outreach work and helping so many people. And so they support me and I get overwhelmed with the love sometimes because it's so great. It's like you can't get down when you keep getting blessed so much. And just because I'm going through these things, the farming doesn't stop.
I wonder if you could give me like a little bit of from where you sit in Arizona, what the landscape looks like for farmers. And as you mentioned, yeah, you're not seeing a lot of Black farmers there.
So the ranching in Arizona is very different than like Texas and things like that. They do grazing, but there's a lot less grass per acre. So you need a lot more acres for your grazing. And so you do usually need to supplement with hay or feed. And right now the big bales were like $300 a big bale at a time. And then sometimes if you get the cheaper bales, your animals will die because the hay is terrible because they send the first cuts to China.
The United States is the largest exporter of hay in the world, where most of the supply goes to Asian countries such as China, Korea, and Japan, followed by Middle Eastern countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE. This is driven by the growing demand in their expanding dairy industries, along with the consistently high quality of hay that the U.S. produces.
And I'm so rural. I'm 2 hours from Tucson. And so there's only like one or two places I can go to get the big bales of hay. But the dynamic of the food in Arizona, it's really bleak because the farms have been driven out of Arizona. We have the number one port in the country for importing food into Nogales. And then where I'm located is actually Douglas, and they're making Douglas the new number one port. So my meat facility is actually on mile marker one from the Border Patrol station where the new port is going to be. So what I found is because we import so much food, they don't support food production here. The food banks, they're supposed to be like a synergistic relationship, kind of like, hey, we buy your food, so we support your food, you know, or we talk to you about when your grow cycles should be because we network with farms across the country.
The symbiotic relationship between food banks and local farms has proven to be a cornerstone in the collective effort to combat food insecurity and promote community resilience. By forging partnerships, local farms have the opportunity to redirect surplus or imperfect produce to food banks, simultaneously reducing agricultural waste and contributing fresh, nutritious options to those in need. A little bit later in this episode, we'll get back to this issue.
But also here, I have a smaller network of women that I've actually sold land to. I'm helping them also try to grow their farms and things like that. But I know how important it is to support the farms, because if we're not supporting the incoming, there's nothing going to come in. And then the farms are being driven out because they're not being supported by the local. They're not being purchased by the local. And I've had larger farms tell me like, oh, don't be surprised if nobody buys from you in your first 2 years. Yeah. Like, it's like very cutthroat. Other than my private clientele who I sell to, I'm really close with ASU and a lot of the heads of their departments. I was on the board at Slow Food, so they've been super supportive of me.
Slow Food is a worldwide grassroots organization committed to safeguarding local food cultures and traditions, mitigating the impact of fast-paced lifestyles, and fostering a deeper appreciation for the origins and consequences of our food choices.
But other than those kind of things, nonprofit-wise, it's really ugly. Even USDA grant-wise, it's really ugly. It's more tokenism than anything. They use you to get the grants, and then they actually don't do anything for the farmers, or then they write the farmers out of the grants. And for the larger farms, the hay subsidies are gone. The alfalfa subsidies are gone now. So now all the hay farms are being driven out. There's water crises all over with the water levels changing. But fortunately, where I am, there's water at like 60 feet. But then they came in and tried to say there's no more water rights here. I already knew this was coming. I've already seen the legislation. Yes. And I tried to fight it. I tried to tell people, you're not voting the right way. You're falling for the wrong thing. And I got the water rights the month before they took them all away. This new legislation going, now if you want to keep your water rights that you've had for 100 years, now you need to apply for them through us. I'm like, these are on your deeds, you guys. You are submitting underneath them when you file the paperwork under them. I look at deeds and I've seen how these rights and things can get transferred down, how wells that are older than a certain age are unregulated. These active management areas, it used to just be Phoenix and Tucson. They added like 5 more. And so it's going to get ugly, but I have like work that I'm doing with my nonprofit to support new incoming small farmers where they can have the smaller parcels because you can only irrigate 2 acres. So this is a long-term plan where they can come in, stay and grow on that 2 acres, irrigate, learn how it goes for the 3 years, and then build up to qualify for the Farm Service Agency loans. Because then they'll have their 3 years of experience in records. I've worked with rural development and like a few other strategic planners and things like that. And I've modeled it after a few different things I've seen. So I'm really excited to have that plan out hopefully next week to some funders, because it's really important that A, people have a chance, but then B, that they have the right guidance to grow correctly, because I feel like everybody's guessing, and not in the big ag world. It's like in the small minority farmer world. And sometimes they just get so much money thrown at them and it's still guesswork. And it's like, why do we have these people over here who are successful, but because they're a different color, we don't talk to them? I'm like, we have mentors with people we can talk to. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. And so I really try to be the middle ground for these people. And I've had really great mentors. I got to meet with one of them a few days ago. She was driving through Tucson on a trip across the country. She's a sheep farmer. She's Navajo and Puerto Rican, actually. And she has a few hundred acres in Oregon. And she helped me a lot because small farmer problems, they cost you so much money. It's so much money when you don't know, like, okay, I'm just buying the livestock because it's cheap, you know? But cheap livestock, oh my God, if you don't vet the breeder, if you don't vet this, even if you're just buying it from an auction, there's a lot of issues. And to build my herds up to that, we went through a lot of different disease. And one time I had expanded, we were way over the 50 sheep, and I bought my livestock from all over the country. I had Savannah goats, and my ram was a prize ram from Minnesota. I got him out here, thankfully. And my sheep, it was like these beautiful wool sheep that I got. I think I got like 20 or something of them, and they just started dying. They just started dying. Like, I was, oh God. And when you're a farmer, you don't want to tell anybody. You're scared you're going to get shut down. The minority farmer problem is you don't necessarily trust the universities, or you don't necessarily trust everybody. So you don't know where you get your information from. I bought $200 cows that were $25. You know what I mean? These are the things you learn later. But with that, I was able to call her and I was bawling my eyes out. Like, I think my ram is gonna die. Like, please help me. And then I learned about Cydectin.
Cydectin is a medication commonly used to control internal and external parasites in cattle, sheep, and other livestock.
And even as a regenerative and organic farmer, there are tools. You don't want your animals to die. You know, there are withholding times if you're going to do the meat, you know, and things like that. So everything can still be good. So it's been so many lessons, you know, of like breeding and grazing and just how to grow. So I'm really excited now to be able to implement and grow and plan and create the environment that I really envisioned the whole time, with the funding necessary to do it. So my nonprofit, it's called People First Global Food and Land Reclamation Foundation. And I've had two conferences, one last year, and we had over 50 people attend. And then this year, we had over 100 people attend. And I had over 4 branches from the USDA. I was so glad that the Farm Service Agency came. And it was actually held the day after I closed on the meat facility. So it was at the meat facility, so people could come and see an actual facility and things like that. And we had some universities come. It was really beautiful. But the thing is, it's building the trust and understanding how the loans work, because out of the whole country, I've only known 3 Black farmers with these farm loans, and mine was one of them. And it's really integral, because what I learned at White Oak was just, I can't explain it. I feel like they're the Disneyland of farms. And it's like you get to see it and experience it and understand it and learn about the soil and the water and caring about the animals all the way down to zero waste with all of the animal parts and the leather. And it's like people don't understand all these connected parts. I think that society compartmentalizes and they don't realize everything is centered on agriculture. Everything. To me, it is, like, other than synthetic stuff. So that's my goal with my facility. But with bringing people together, of the 3 Black farms, one is actually from Guyana, South America. And he farms in Seattle, and his family bought the plantation they grew up on. And he's the one who told me to go for the Farm Service Agency loan. And the other one was in Texas, and he had he had 200 acres. And when I went on a tour across the country meeting with farms with my nonprofit in January of 2022, that was like, to me, seeing a Black farm owner with 200 acres, that was life-changing. Growing up in Chico, California, they produce a third of the world's nuts. But as much agriculture is there, I didn't know about any of it really. And you see the farmers, but you don't really identify as one, or you don't think that's possible for me. Sometimes the minorities just think they are the farm workers and they can't be the farmers. And so that's the type of shift that I try to do with my nonprofit work. And that's what's for me right now is like the mental shift I'm having. And I just appreciate people like you or like the podcasts, you know, learning from the bigger farms, learning how it doesn't have to be this set way. And then my one farmer friend from Oregon, my mentor, she told me about testing the fecal matter, testing for diseases. And I didn't trust that stuff at first either. And I learned, okay, you can send it to whatever facility you want, whatever barrier you have, there's always solutions. But if you think your box is like this, you know, you're never going to go outside of it. And I know the world is bleak right now. I know it's bad. This is why I do everything I do, you know, because I don't want people to think what's impossible to get a farmer loan. Oh, the USDA is always bad or this or that. You know, I have a lot of great, wonderful people that I've met through this. Yeah, there are issues, but I try to really break down these barriers. And it really is for my children. I really want my children to grow up and not just like, oh, have a fair shake. No, I want them to learn, think for themselves, know how it works, whether we're hauling water or whether we have water rights. You know what I mean? But I love agriculture. I didn't think that was what was going to save me. I didn't think that was going to be my mission in life, but here we are.
So as you look at the future, you're opening your USDA facility is going to be really instrumental for your farm. You're expanding your livestock and continuing with your farming, and you're helping BIPOC farmers really understand that they can get started, that there are other people there to help them, and that you're providing them with support and connecting them with people who can support them regardless of the color of their skin. And what else? Is there something else you haven't told me about that's on your radar screen?
I'm real passionate about the meat. I'm real happy and excited to be doing the meat. And that's why I want to support other people in animal production, because the University of Arizona shut down their USDA facility. So there's literally only one cattle inspection facility out here. And then when I went to Nevada to buy sheep and goats, they told me the same thing. The USDA facility shut down. Many people are getting out of livestock production now because of that down here.
In the last two decades, USDA meat processing facilities have been closing all over the United States, where they are now consolidating them into larger facilities and are concentrated in certain areas of the country, but are further away from local farms, causing farms to close that can't afford to open their own USDA meat processing facilities.
I really am trying to support people staying in it. All the little things build up to the long-term things, you know, so that's why it's so important to support the farmers. And I just appreciate you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you too. And all that you're doing is very inspiring. And I have two more questions.
Yes.
One gets us back into the middle of it and one will take us out. First, you mentioned something about the port and how important it was. Talk to me a little bit about what's going on.
Well, it's so many folds because we're importing so much food from Mexico. And so they're like, well, we have an abundance of food because it gets rejected at the border and then the food banks all buy it. So they have this abundance of food so they don't have to support the farmers at all.
So Arizona is eating mainly stuff that's coming from Mexico and not supporting local farmers.
Yes, it's a big business because when the food gets rejected, they buy it for 2 cents on the pound and then one of them sells it for like 17 cents on the pound. And they distribute it across the country to different food banks. That's why in Nogales, there's all these different food facilities where they're set up for the food to come in and cross over. Now we're in Douglas, where there's a population is less than 14,000. They're not set up with the food facilities yet. We're not set up with the storage facilities yet. So I'm really trying to help build the infrastructure to get ready. In the next 5 years, there's going to be a new highway. But it's the food storage, the cold storage, the dry storage. These are things that really matter long term here. So I'm really trying to get people into that thought process, the economic thought process of that for your farms. And because I know how cutthroat the food is, like, don't just grow your crop, make a product. Have something that can be stored if possible. That's why these food storage facilities loans, they're new with the USDA. I think they're really important. There's a micro loan that's $50,000 or the a different one that's $500,000. But you have to be in food production for 3 years to get it. But we need the food storage facilities. We need to grow this infrastructure because people are just dying out. The food is going. And when you can hold that food, your commodity, you can get a lot more for it. You don't just have to be at the mercy of the season. You know what I mean? So I think it's really, really important for us to think long term. And the food crisis is real. I've known it's real since 2020. I just don't get bogged down and we're going to die tomorrow. But the Douglas port coming here is going to be a lot of economic development. It's going to be a lot of gentrification. The land values are going to go up. This is where I sell land privately with the land company. So I try to tell people, buy the land, you guys, buy land. It matters. It's the best investment you could ever have. And my first video I made in 2020 was how to buy land because I just saw that nobody knows about land ownership. They don't know about buying land. And then they get so skeptical. They think it's fake. There are scams everywhere. So it's dicey. They don't know about title companies or just different things, different ways. It is the wild, wild west.
So my other question is this. Less than 2% of the US population are farmers and even less are Black farmers. So I think that we're talking, yes, sometimes to farmers on this podcast, because I think they're looking for community and learning and having empathy and support. But we're also talking to that 98% who are not farmers. And I think you shared so many interesting things today that are going to have people's heads spinning. But I'm wondering if you have a message that you would like to share, something important that you would really like people who are not farmers to know and understand.
I don't think it's ever too late to get into farming. I think that as the careers are shifting and technology is rising, that people think, oh, what can I do? What can I do? You do need to be able-bodied. You do need to function and do things and not rely on grants. Do not rely on grants or think that a teaching farm is what is going to save you, because I just see model after model of unsuccessful things happening, unsustainable things happening. So really understanding the finances behind it is important. But we all need food. We all eat. I just see so many people limiting where they feel their careers are their goals. Oh, I can't do this. I can't do that. Well, as long as you're saying you can't, then you're not going to. If you do feel like you can and you want to, there are programs, there are things that can help you, any race. And even though you might be the lonely farm out there, if you can connect with other bigger farms, if you can learn from them, it's really, really important. And then the farms like you guys who do see the people and you do help them, it's life-changing. I don't forget when people help me. It stays with me, you know, and that's why I always try to help people. I talked with somebody yesterday and they're like, well, how are you going to do this with you're getting all these animals or you're expanding your farm or this or that? I said, I do it with no funding. I can't not help the people. I can't not advise them if they're trying to buy land or they're trying to do this. If I have this knowledge, of course I want to share the knowledge. Of course I want to. And now I'm just trying to streamline it so it's a lot less on me and streamline it so that way I can direct them where they need to go. So really try not to think of why you can't, but really think about why you can. And don't overdo your commodities. Don't do more than three things. Really focus on those commodities, how you can make them successful. Learn what all your inputs are. Learn what all your costs are and really create a successful plan that you can try to stick to. And just know it takes 3 years for any business to really be sustainable or successful. Usually you dip down and then you really rise back up. So it is going to be hard. It is going to be tough, but I just think farming is worth it. When you're connected to the earth, you're connected to the land and the animals, it's like a healing thing as well. So I really try to share it with as many people as possible.
From fitness to farming, Rachel Stewart is a tireless advocate for more people getting into farming. And she is willing to step up and give advice and provide connections as people have done for her. It's not for the faint of heart. I know you can feel the passion and hard work that Rachel puts into her work, into her own farm, and her community of farmers. Rachel and Stewart Pastures received one of the first-year grants that the Four Farmers Movement awarded, and you can see how it, albeit small, has impacted her work. Yes, the money counts, but more than that, the vote of confidence in her direction and the power of all of those $1 contributions mean more than their sum. Thank you for being here with me and Rachel on the Talk Farm to Me podcast, where we bring you closer to the power of your choices, one farmer at a time. Since you are still here with me, can you do me a really helpful favor and rate the podcast on Apple or Spotify? I am the worst at asking you to do this, but it will really help others find it. If you're not on either of those platforms, you can rate it right on the talkfarmtome.com website. You're the best. Thank you. Well, that's a wrap. I'm your host, Dana DePrima. This podcast is produced by me with support from Sonia Dillon and sound design by Russell Chapa. I look forward to talking farm with you again soon, maybe at a farm near you.
Hey, go-getters, let Noom Sport Hydration Tablets power up your fun and keep you ready to move. Simply drop, dissolve, and enjoy crisp and refreshing flavors like strawberry lemonade or lemon lime with 5 essential electrolytes and crafted with clean, non-GMO, vegan, and gluten-free ingredients. Noom should be your go-to hydration choice because when you're hydrated, you can do more, go further, and recover quicker. Shop now on noonlife.com and get ready for endless fun because anything can happen after noon.